With respect to the call for action that you referenced, I would make note of the fact that there is indeed increasing traction among international organizations, nations, foundations, private sector, and so forth to address these issues. Our next speaker is Dr. Peter Hobbs, and he'll speak to us about sustainability, the sustainability initiatives, intensifications that we've already heard about this morning. Peter is the Associate Director of International Programs at the College of Agriculture at Cornell. He's an agronomist in the Crop and Soil Sciences Department there, and he's worked internationally with CIMMYT and IRI and in Asia in a number of capacities. So my pleasure to present Dr. Hobbs.
Okay, thank you very much. Before I start, I want to just say a few words. We've had some excellent presentations this morning that have talked about looking at a holistic and systems-based scenario. And, of course, that means we need to have multiple stakeholders, multiple disciplines, and public, private, advanced, developing countries. And so one of the most important things that I've got from my 30 years overseas and 10 years at Cornell is the need to collaborate. In other words, we need to be able to communicate with our partners, and I think this is something we need to think about. But I still think there's a role for our lowly, clod-kicking agronomists like myself. And I was weaned on the farming systems initiatives that we had in the 80s, where we did try to look at things in a more holistic way. But we still had to break them down into components. If you really wanted to do anything, you had to do research at your level, and then you could upscale this information to by accelerating adoption with local farmers. And so I think this is really important. I did want a couple of things I heard about this morning. One is that India is really concerned about meeting their food security needs in the future. And they've had some high-level meetings recently, and they will be investing a lot in agricultural research. They already invest a lot of money. And then they have a new policy called the Right to Food. And that's going to be another interesting part of the equation in those countries. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the Feed the Future. Sustainable intensification or sustainable land management is another term. I don't think we should get lost in terms. I've got conservation agriculture here. I think sustainable land management may be a better term. Of course, when we do sustainable intensification, we do need sustainable funding. And one of the things we need for sustainable funding is to maybe have the donors work together and once again collaborate and communicate with each other so that we increase the efficiency with which we use this. And the other really important thing, my new hat at Cornell is working with young undergraduates and graduates and Humphrey Fellows and Borlaug Fellows, et cetera, is having sustainable manpower and training the manpower, training them to be able to work as collaborators in the future. So I'm already out of time, so I will try to go through this. I'm going to talk to you from an agronomy point of view, and so I'm going to pick a really narrow part of the of this holistic thing. So here are some in future agricultural challenges, and I talk to my undergraduate students, say, "Hey, this is your challenge. You have to do this: food security and the nutritional needs, minimizing the effects on the environment." And the really important thing made by some previous speakers, we have to also improve the livelihoods. So things like markets obviously are really important. Estimates suggest 70% more food is needed by 2050, and we can only do that if we improve the efficiency of natural resource use and reduce field and storage losses, and then transfer innovative management systems to farmers. This is really really, really key. When we have demand for food is increasing, harvested area, and I should admit that I'm talking more about South Asia, where I spent most of my life. Harvested area per capita is shrinking. Traditional sources of productivity growth are already being used. Competition and demands for blue water is increasing. Future oil prices and the effect that's going to have on higher input and transport costs. Global climate change and severe weather. I think it's more of a severe weather as a result of greenhouse gas emissions. Land degradation is already happening. Dietary changes, biofuels, less investment in research and human resource. So these are all the things that have been covered recently. Business as usual will not get the job done. And I think Hans has pointed this out and some of the other people here. We cannot feed the future based on what we're doing right now. And here's a nice picture from Brazil showing what happens if you don't do things right. You're losing your topsoil, etc. So as an agronomist, I put this up as soil health is a key agronomic component for producing food. The soil is like the mother load. As he said, if we have highways instead of, and when we put our improved seed on highways, we're not going to get very much. And on the right, you see a healthy soil. On the left is an unhealthy soil. And so we at Cornell, we have a program now where we're looking more at the combination of physical, chemical, and biological components. And we all know, if we're in agronomy and had any background in soils, what the physical attributes are, what the chemical ones are. And more important, or very important, and ones that we tend to neglect are the biological components, the nutrient cycling, organic matter decomposition, nitrogen fixation, which we've already heard, suppression of disease, etc. And it's a genetic reservoir for a lot of our biotechnology and genes for in transgenic crops. And we can look at some of the indicators that we have for physical health on the left-hand side, for chemical health, and also for biological health. And today in New York State, we can actually provide farmers, they can send in soil samples, and we'll actually give them a soil analysis, not just chemical, physical and biological as well. And so if we look at what is a degraded soil, the number of things here, low organic matter, although some of the highest wheat productivity in India is on sandy soils with no organic matter. Looking at some of those degraded soils, if we look at the same thing for a healthy soil, it would have higher organic matter, improved nutrient cycling, less pathogens, balanced fertility. And so a healthy soil is what you would find in a forest soil, not disturbed with leaf mulch, whereas degraded soils are what we're beginning to see in intensively mined agricultural soils with no organic amendments. Fertilizers are not bad. They're needed. They're the food for the crops. But what we're tending to do is to substitute chemical fertilizer for a balanced fertilizer that has both organic and inorganic components. If you look at the same thing in the way they're managed in a degraded soil, no addition of organic matter, only use chemical fertilizer, excessive tillage, pesticides, mining of nutrients, erosion, etc. Whereas on a healthy soil, we use organic amendments, minimum soil disturbance, use of surface mulching, use of IPM, etc. And so this is present farming practices on the left. And this is this, what I call sustainable land management on the right, like conservation agriculture. Or we had another term we coined in South Asia called resource conserving technologies. Because we didn't really go the whole way with conservation agriculture, but we did use components of this. And one of the things that we see in South Asia is this tillage addiction. There's a sort of, well, my grandfather did it, my father did it, so it must be good. And so we have this addiction, and you have this sort of downward spiral in soil health because of tillage. It's particularly an issue in some of the tropical areas where you have more oxidation of organic matter. And so the thing is tillage necessary? Or are we just burning our money and contributing to global climate change through carbon dioxide oxidation of organic matter? And so one of the terms that was being coined by FAO back quite a number of years ago is something called conservation agriculture. It's different than conservation tillage. Conservation tillage came up as a result of the Dust Bowl in the 1930s. Minimum soil disturbance, zero tillage if possible. Permanent soil cover, residues of the past crop or cover crops can be grown. No burning of the residues. And then rotations, mainly for residue pest, disease, and weed control. And I've added a fourth one, which says that we still need to use integrated practices. We still need to not throw out the baby with the bathwater. We still need to use our common sense and say, let's use integrated practices for weed, pest, and disease control. Definitely needs flexibility in definition, and we need to adapt to all the local conditions. And this is where it's really important. I considered myself to be a catalyst when I worked overseas. I spent my 30 years in the field with the local scientists and the local national systems. And there's you definitely need to have a diagnostic phase to your research, try to understand what's the log jam in your production systems, and then working with the local farmers and with the local scientists, come up with ways of adapting your technology to their situations. So residue retention distinguishes conservation agriculture from conventional farming. And you see, we don't plow under the residues. We leave the residues on the surface. The plant cover is not incorporated into the soil by tillage. And conservation agriculture is different from conservation tillage in that less soil disturbance. So conservation tillage is really a part of the way towards conservation agriculture. Some of the benefits, I tried to speed up so we have a little bit more time for discussion. Typically, but not always, reduced erosion because of the soil cover and because of the no-till, increased water infiltration and therefore soil moisture. Very important in rain-fed situations. Reduced yield loss from drought. As Hans said, I don't think you can develop a wheat variety that has drought stress to no water. So it has to have more water. Increased soil carbon. This is something which, if you read, there's a lot of literature now coming out on conservation agriculture, and you see that with conservation agriculture, it must have no-till and the residue cover, not just no-till. That you have both of those, you are getting an increase in soil carbon, maybe only in the surface layers, but also lower down. Increased soil biological activity, which is really, really important, which improves soil fertility. Reducing the cost of production, that's one of the main reasons why farmers are adopting this. Improved timeliness of operations, if you don't have to. In South Asia, when we had the rice would harvest, we would plow, the people I work with, the farmers, may plow their fields 20 times in order to get a good seed bed. They wanted to have this nice, fine seed bed, so they'll go over it 20 times. How long does it take one farmer with a pair of bullocks to plow 20 times? And how many miles does he walk is quite incredible. And we're also finding maybe over time higher productivity. How long does it take to get the full benefits? It varies, sometimes straight away. Sometimes it takes a long time. And you have these possible transition periods which you have to overcome in order to, you may have some new problems. Weed control is one of them that you have to overcome in order to make it successful. Soil biology, I think I want to make the emphasis on soil biology because it's something, because it's below ground. We don't see it. We don't bother to look at it. Numerous organisms are involved in soil organic matter formation and nutrient cycling activities. As we use some genetic biotech markers to be able to find, we're finding that there's an incredible population of organisms below the ground that we never knew existed before. And you're getting these really interesting diagrams showing lots of different organisms that we didn't even know were there. We don't even know what their functions are at the moment. Healthy roots are really important, and the associations of roots with biological organisms, rhizobia, mycorrhiza, antifungal agents. Soil microbes, if a healthy soil has diversity of organisms, and those diversity of organisms help protect their own territory and help to reduce diseases. Some microbes help control disease, antifungal action. And a healthy soil essentially has more microbes than an unhealthy soil. So an unhealthy soil or degraded soil is going to have less microbes, and you're going to have more pathogenic organisms proliferating. Global adoption of conservation agriculture is up to the latest. There was a congress in Brisbane just recently of about 120 million hectares. So you don't get 120 million hectares of adoption unless it has some benefits to the farmers that are adopting it. So we're not talking about a small thing. This is a tillage revolution or brown revolution in the future. Mostly it started off in South America, but it's growing in other parts of the world. So I want to talk about a couple of case studies, and the one I want to start off with is the legacy of Brazil. In the developing world, the greatest success in conservation and agriculture is found in Brazil and Argentina in the developing world. These figures are probably need to be updated now, but there were 23 million hectares in Brazil and 18 million hectares in Argentina of conservation agriculture, 45 to 60% of the agricultural land. And it was a source of it's been a source of inspiration for other countries in developed and developing countries. And the practices include crop establishment into a layer of mulch. You find large machinery in some of these countries, but I should also point out that there's also a lot of potential for animal, manual, small-scale mechanization. It doesn't have to be large equipment in these particular countries. Usually planting into a layer of mulch. One of the interesting things, most important things, is the development of the machinery to allow you to do that. And there needs to be investment in local industries, local adaption of specialized equipment that allows you to be able to plant not only the seed, but also place the fertilizer into these particular situations. And then suitable crop rotations for these. How did this happen? The story begins with government policy, a farmer response, and then the ensuing crisis. Let me just put these down so we don't have to, we can read them. So the policy that was introduced in Brazil was to encourage farmers to shift from coffee and livestock to annual cropping systems. The farmer response was to a substantial shift to crops, especially soybeans, maize, and various other crops. This is in areas with high rainfall, rolling topography, and erodible soils. And this is what the crisis happened in those areas because of this. So when they switched to these annual cropping systems, they had a crisis, massive and widespread soil erosion, farmers becoming bankrupt, unable to pay their bank loans. And the response, maybe terracing, reversion back to their original coffee and livestock, or use of soil cover. And this is where conservation and agriculture emerged from a desperate attempt to deal with this essential crisis. The crisis was soil erosion, and the response was a bit like the Dust Bowl, was to leave the conservation and agriculture. So local farm champions, one of the interesting things here is that the farmers became the champions. And they later organized themselves into conservation and agriculture groups. There was a local farm implement manufacturer called Semiato that developed a piece of equipment that would allow them to do conservation and agriculture. And outside suppliers of prototype implements. So there was a linkage between the University of Kentucky and the equipment manufacturers in Brazil. Then the researchers, there was also an external mentor, somebody who was there, a champion who was there in the country to keep pushing to get this done. And then the researchers came online. In general, research organizations did not lead, nor the extension. In fact, they lagged behind. They didn't think that this would work, which was interesting. So, what did they do? There were farmer visits to Kentucky, return visits to Brazil, import of prototype implements, farmer experimentation, and then continued implement adaptation, adapting the technology to the local conditions. And then there was facilitation and backstopping by Dirks, and later by Pat Wall, who was our at CIMMYT conservation agriculture leader. In other words, using funding from USAID, using funding from the CG system, we were the catalyst. We were feeding this system to get it operational. So we had a social system, which was self-sustaining because it was locally produced, in which stakeholders interact in several ways and helped enabled upscaling of this technology. There were lots of stakeholders, public research and extension, innovative farmers, commercial firms, foreign research institutions, and they formed networks that co-evolved with the technologies that they created. So we had these innovative networks being formed. So we had innovative networks and this is what I said at the really beginning. We need to be able to collaborate and communicate in these networks. So, the problem with soil erosion. Soil cover was not introduced for its own sake, but as a means of controlling erosion. A bit like the Dust Bowl, you have crop cover as a way of controlling wind erosion in the Dust Bowl. And no-till came along because, hey, how do you get the seed into this stuff? How do you get your seed with the equipment that you have into this permanent residue cover? You had the same thing in the United States with conservation tillage, okay? So you had so you see, no-till was introduced for its own sake, but as a means of sowing into soil cover. So, let me just put this up quickly. What happens is that a new problem emerged, and so you needed new solutions. So continuous wheat soybean cropping with soil cover led to disease problems, including weeds. So new crop rotations were introduced as a means of disease control. And then use of Roundup Ready soybeans resolved the weed problem. But I think today maybe they're also looking at the possibility of integrated weed management to control the weeds. So each element in the three pillars emerged as a means of achieving a very clearly defined benefit. So just a checklist of factors, a crisis situation, you had a solution, local champions, availability of prototype implements, study tours, farmer experimentation, private sector adaptation, external mentoring and facilitation, and then you had a self-sustaining dynamic innovation system. You can see the adoption rates of no-till or conservation agriculture in Brazil. You see that period from 1970 to 1990, a sort of transition period where it takes time That's why I say you need sustainable funding and you need sustainable manpower, because this may take time. But look, as soon as you had the enabling factors in place, the thing just has taken off. And if you go and talk to the farmers now in that area and you say, well, are you going to go back to traditional agriculture and plowing? And they said, no way. We're going to stick with this system. Some of the farmers there have now been doing no-till conservation agriculture for 27 years. So in 2004, okay. Now we'll quick go to another one in South Asia, one that I was involved with, the Rice Wheat Consortium, for about 30 years. And I won't spend a lot of time on this because this was covered yesterday by Andy McDonald in the session we had yesterday. Here were the major problems here. They're not so much erosion. We had late planting of wheat after rice. Okay? You plant your wheat late, and you run into problems at the end of the season. You also run into problems at the beginning. And also, we had the emergence of a grassy weed called Phalaris minor that developed resistance to the herbicides that we used at that time. It got to the point where, you can see this field here, actually there was more Phalaris minor than there is wheat. And a lot of farmers would just harvest it for fodder and take it off. They would get zero wheat yield. There was also poor water use efficiency. And this is in an area where we're getting about half a meter decline in water table every year. So it was a place where we had to increase water efficiency. And then there were some other problems. So we introduced something that we call resource conserving technologies here. Practices that enhance resource or input use efficiency. And some of these that we had, zero till. We found that, hey, we didn't need to do tillage to get the wheat established into these rice paddies. There was enough moisture in the soil. We could plant earlier. We could get higher yields because of this. We actually had less weed problems because we didn't disturb the soil, and so we didn't get as much germination of this weed. We had many benefits. Laser leveling, new varieties that use nutrients more efficiently, and many others. And if you're interested, there's a whole mass of things going on in South Asia with this. I want to talk a little bit about Southern Africa and the West African Sahel. The problems here is we have thin soils, low soil organic matter, low soil fertility, low water holding capacity, short rainy season, and sometimes the soils are susceptible to heavy crusting, and we have low yields. Now, when you first introduced slash and burn in some of these areas, the soils were very productive. But just through mismanagement, poor agronomy, poor input use in these areas, soils, this is the sort of crop that you might see. Compare that to a maize crop in the Midwest, where you're getting 9-10 tons per hectare. Is this the result of unsustainable farming practices? That's where I come up with the thing: business as usual is not going to get the job done. So problems but we have some problems with conservation agriculture in Africa. And Ken Giller and various other people have put out things, saying, well, we have issues with conservation agriculture. Minimum soil disturbance, zero tillage, direct sowing. One of the problems is that this increases weeds, or there's few suitable implements available. So here's an issue that needs to be looked at. Permanent soil cover. Mainly used for moisture conservation as much as moisture control. It's very difficult to achieve in Africa. Low biomass production, competing livestock fodder needs. How does the farmer balance between feeding the soil versus feeding their animals? So we have this issue. And then innovative diversified rotations. Moisture may not be adequate for double cropping. Markets. You produce, you say, let's have diversification, and you bring in this great crop, pigeon pea, and the farmers don't know how to eat it, and there's no market for it. So markets, and not enough staple foods. My major professor when I was at Reading University was Professor Bunting. And he was involved with the groundnut scheme in Sudan. And so he always used to say, you know, if you don't have markets, you know, you're wasting your time. So how do we adapt the principles of a technology developed in Brazil to meet a sudden crisis for erosion and disease control in a high rainfall hilly area? Okay. Two, conditions of a semi-arid area with low biomass production, livestock grazing of residues, and minimal disease pressure. Okay, so we've got conservation agriculture. And so here's a couple of examples of the way forward. One is there's a really interesting Zai system in Burkina Faso. It's a pit system. You dig a pit, you break the plow pan so that you can get better rooting. And in fact, I believe in the Zai system in Burkina Faso, they even inoculate these pits with termites to try to get nutrient recycling. It's very interesting. Hand-formed planting pits done in the dry season. And that's really interesting because you can do these pits in the dry season. As soon as the rains hit, you're ready to plant. Whereas in the traditional system, you have to wait until the rains come before you can even start land preparation. Shaped to collect rainwater, filled with compost or farmyard manure. Crop is hand-sown into the compost. And so the conservation agriculture principles here, soil cover and direct sowing. And we're trying to maintain the same pits every year so that you don't have to do that digging every year. The only problem is trying to find them the second year. When I went to Zambia and saw this, I thought, well, where were they from last year? No, there wasn't very much left. All the residues are gone, and you had trouble finding where the pits were. So what about permanent basins is what we're talking about here. I'll try and finish. So I just want to show a few pictures. These shows the basins in Zambia. We went to Zambia. We have these small pits with maize. They had a rotation system. They could grow cotton, soybeans, and maize over a three-year cycle in Zambia. Here's a close-up showing the pit with the residues in there, the compost. Hand tools, simple hand tools. We don't really need a lot on this, but these can be improved. You can see a picture here on the size adding compost added to the system. And then the other really important thing is this microdosing. Without using, we're not talking about using fertilizer doses that you would in the United States, but adding small amounts, those small amounts can make a big impact on biomass production and therefore help farmers maybe use some of it for animal feed and some of it for feeding the soil. And this happens in the first year, and then in the second year, what you would do is just loosen up the soil, and then you put more compost on or more residues on the surface and plant into that permanent hole. This is a little bit on microdosing, just the benefits of just very small amounts, 17 kgs of nitrogen or 35 kgs of nitrogen, a little bit of extra fertilizer, essentially. Things. Another example of the way forward is with ripping, using a ripper to do the same thing. You just but in Zambia they didn't have any animals, so they had to do everything by hand. So you once again, when you go to these countries, you can't come in. They don't have tractors, so don't forget about using mechanized systems. So let me just see. I think I will try to finish there. I want to put this up. There's a lot of changes necessary to adopt zero tillage or conservation agriculture. But the biggest change is in the mind. That's the biggest change that we had to overcome. And it took us many years to actually. And the way we had to do it was to work with an innovative farmer. That innovative farmer then became our best extension specialist, because he would talk to his neighbors. His neighbors would see what he was doing. If he did it, then they should be able to do it. So you had to allow the farmers to experiment with the technology and adapt it to their local conditions. I just wanted to put this one in, and that is that we have to think also at different scales. A lot of this presentation is looking at a scale of field level, but we can also look at it as at a watershed level. And so the effects of upstream water pollution are felt downstream. And this is an example from one of the global water programs in Ecuador, where the people downstream were reliant on a reservoir for water and for industry. But what was happening is that what farmers were doing upstream was causing the dams to fill up with mud. And so what eventually has happened here is that the recipients of the water downstream are paying the farmers upstream to adopt conservation agriculture principles to reduce erosion. So you can have these landscape scale. So what incentives do upstream people have to control pollution? Okay. So this is I just put this in. Sustainable land management will need collaboration of soil science, agronomy, plant pathology, natural resource management, ecology, environmental sciences, economics, climatology, sociology, and many other disciplines in order to be successful. But also farmers, private sector, NGOs, public sector agencies, and more. So that's all. Thank you very much.